place where you feared for your life. You thought, this just may be it. I'm about to go. Now, some people do this on purpose, to jump out of airplanes. I'm not going to do that. But I was in an airplane one time, an old Navy SNJ. It wasn't old then, old now. But the old SNJ, we had a flight instructor school, and I was part of the crew. I had to fly 4 hours a month in order to get 50% more on my paycheck, so I was flying that day. Any flight that goes up, you try to get on it and go up for an hour. We came back in about noon. I could hear the radio. And they were saying, don't land. They waved us off. Something wrong. Your landing gear doesn't look right to us. So go up and try it out. So we went up and we had to shake it down. You did all kind of shaking stuff to get that thing down. Came back by and they said, no, still looks the same, but try it. Bounce it on the runway a couple of times, then take it back off. So we bounced it on the runway. I'm sitting in the back seat, you know, the stupid seat. I'm not flying. I'm just sitting there, a passenger. I'm watching this thing, boom, boom, boom. Came back up and said, well, still doesn't look so good, but try it anyway. What? Well, you can't stay up there all day. So they brought us down there, and there's the fire truck and the crash crews out there and people in the hangars on the runway. You see them all standing out there. What's going on? What's going on? I imagine some of them knew who was up in the plane. We came down, and I was busy taking off my parachute. You don't need a parachute at 10 feet. So I took the parachute off in case I had to get out of there. Came down, landed as though nothing ever happened. I don't know what that was, but I'm telling you, this old boy was wondering, is this it? And it could have been. Well, that kind of thing, I don't know that. I didn't know that at that time. But the Lord was taking care of me. He had something for me to do, you know. And the same thing is true of all of us. I'm sure you've all been in situations like that. And I've been in them since, too, at my own hand. You know, you pull out in front of somebody, he slams on his brakes, and he saved you. The Lord saved you, you know. The Lord put his hand there, you know, that kind of thing. But the Lord is able. And Paul found himself in a position where he could have been killed. They wanted to kill him. They were about to. They had him in the place where they could have. So Paul, in chapter 21, verse 27 to 31, Paul, the crowd was angered. The people were angered at Paul. Now, his accusers are seen in 27 and 28. Verse 27 says this, now when the 7 days were almost ended, just remember, he's wanting to offer the sacrifice for the people and all that. The Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him. Now, these people, their identification, they are Ephesian Jews. Jews who lived in Ephesus, who came to Jerusalem, and they were against Paul. They knew what Paul had done in Ephesus. He had evangelized Asia Minor there. They knew what he was doing. So these people were Jews. They were from Ephesus. And they were not believers. This is not believers against Paul, but unbelievers. They had no part in that decision for Paul to go into the temple. None of that. They weren't in on that at all. These were Jewish unbelievers. And they'd been watching Paul, looking for something. How can we catch Paul, you know? We'll get him and we'll get the mob to kill him because we don't like Paul. And they didn't like Paul, not so much because of him. They didn't like Paul because of his message, the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, so they're watching him and find something. And it doesn't have to be true. Just make the accusation. And if you get the accusation just right, Paul's done. So that was their identification. Now their indignation. Verse 28, they say, they're crying out, men of Israel, help! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people and the law and this place. And furthermore, he also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled the holy place. Now, note the areas covered here. It said, he teaches all men everywhere. Now, that's a little hyperbole, but they might have meant everywhere he goes, he's teaching people these things. He's, remember, these people are Jewish, and he's saying, they're calling out to the Jewish people, men of Israel, right? Men of Israel, You are of Israel. You have a responsibility. Somebody's in the temple wrong. A Gentile's in the temple. And you men of Israel must protect your temple. That's the whole idea. It happens in other places. I remember the Welsh national anthem. How in the world did you learn that? I don't know. I found it somewhere. It was in How Green Was My Valley. They sang that quite a bit. And that starts off with, men of Harlech, honor calls us, no proud section error. They're men of honor, men of Harlech, men of Wales. You must get out here and do things because after all, you are the men of this place. You must protect this place. And that's what they're saying. And this idea of men of Israel, they want them to do that. They want to get them in that. So they're Jewish people. It says that he has broken the Mosaic law. This is not just a law, but the Mosaic law. Remember the Mosaic law? It was over about 15, 20 years ago. You know, but nothing said that here. They were still worshiping according to the Mosaic law, and they're worshiping in this place, the temple. Now, the temple was no longer a viable place of worship. God was not watching them. God was not honoring the worship in the temple. No, they weren't, anything they were doing was wrong. And it's true today. Anything Judaism does is wrong, apart from Jesus Christ. So they were, he said, then they said he brought Jews into the temple, Gentiles into the temple. And this was false. He did not do that. Now, why would that be so terrible? Well, the Gentiles were not allowed into the place, the temple area proper. They weren't allowed in there. In fact, they had a sign at the entrance that said this: no foreigner may enter into within the barricade that surrounds the temple and enclosure. Anyone caught doing so will have himself to blame for his ensuing death. In other words, you're going to die if you do that. And archaeologists have found two of these signs. They found one in 1938. I was around then. Then they also found one in 1871. I kind of missed that one. But they found that these signs were there. And that it was not just storybook. They were in that thing. And they were saying, you're going to die if you go in there. So it was a serious matter. They had a middle wall that kept the Gentiles out. A division between us, the Jews, who are the people, and all those people out there, those dirty Gentiles, they can't come into our temple. That's a great way to worship, you know. So they had a middle wall, and the middle wall was there to keep them out. That may be what Paul had in mind when he talked about the middle wall of partition had been broken down. You see the temple there and the here's the court of the Gentiles, and the sign was apparently right in here somewhere, and they couldn't go. Over here, we're going to talk later on about the fortress of Antonio. That's what we're talking about right there. They could come into there, the court of the Gentiles, but no farther. That's it. So Paul wrote this: for he himself is our peace, speaking of Jesus, who has made both one, both what? Both Jew and Gentile, one, and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in the ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace, and that he might reconcile them both to God in one body through the cross, thereby putting to death the enmity. No more. That's what Christ died for, he's saying. Here, he's a victim of the fact that they had not learned that. This peace, this whole thing meant that the Gentiles were lacking in five areas. Let me give them to you quickly. First, they were separated from God. They were without God, separated from him. They, not only personally, of course, all people apart from Christ are separated personally, but they were separated nationally. They had no national hope, as the Jews did, of a Messiah coming to deliver them. Secondly, they were excluded from the citizenship in Israel. This sign shouted that. You're not a citizen. Get out of here, you know. And they were excluded from that according to Romans 9:4. They had no citizenship in Israel. Third, they were foreigners to the covenants of promise, Ephesians 3:6. Now, they had nothing to do with the covenants. Those covenants were given to Israel and only to Israel. Oh, yeah, later on, they're going to be the Jews, the Gentiles are going to be involved in the new covenant in the millennium in some sub-status or whatever. But, they're separated from it. The Abrahamic covenant, remember, had three prongs, three promises. The land promise, the Palestinian covenant, delineated that. And then we had David with the Davidic covenant, with the nation promise. And then the Mosaic covenant with the blessing promise. So that's the way blessing came through the Mosaic covenant. Well, that Mosaic covenant has been replaced by, and even at that point, had been replaced by the new covenant from Jeremiah 31. And the New Testament states it very, very, very plainly. In Hebrews chapter 7 through 9, especially chapter 8. Chapter 8 is just decimating anybody who says the Mosaic covenant is still in force. And then in 2 Corinthians 3, another place. So they were without hope, any hope. Unlike Israel, they had no expectation of a deliverer. So no hope at all. And then fifth, they were without God in the world. They had no God. The Gentiles had no meaning, they had no hope, they had no purpose, no direction in life, they had nothing. And the same is true of anyone who does not know Jesus Christ as Savior. They are in the same fix. They have nothing, no purpose or anything else. So, because Paul said, for we live in Him, we live, we move, we have our very being, Acts 17. So, and remember this, Judaism today is no closer than they were then. Judaism is no closer than Buddhism or Hinduism or Mohammedanism. It's nothing. Judaism has no break at all in this whole thing. Either you know Jesus Christ and you come to God by Him, or you are nothing, totally apart from Him. So in Galatians 3:28, then in the church, he says, and that's all there is, just the church that God's dealing with. He says, there is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave or free. There is neither male nor female. You are all one in Christ. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. He's saying that God didn't do away with all the promises He made to Israel. He's going to keep them, but the Gentiles are going to be a part of that as well, as you'll see. So, God was in effect saying this. You leaders, tear down that wall. See, that guy wasn't original after all. But they didn't tear it down. And then God tore it down for them in 70 AD, not very far after this period, a couple of years, 12 years, God tore it down. Not only that wall, but all the walls came tumbling down. And not one stone was left upon another in the temple that was not thrown down, AD 70. So those were the accusers. They weren't the Jews from Jerusalem as much as the ones from outside. Now, they made a false accusation, according to verse 29, for they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. Now, Paul could go into the temple if he wanted. He could go wherever he wanted. He was a Jew, a rabbi even. And so he could go wherever he wanted. But they accused him of taking Trophimus, the Gentile, into the area where he was not supposed to go. And to the mob, that was enough. You just accuse him, and the mob said, oh, yeah, let's go. And we've seen mobs in the last couple of months all around the world and even in our own country. So mobs take take it and go with it, whatever it is. I have a little problem, and I got a little picture of it even this morning. What did he mean? They supposed that Paul had taken Trophimus into the place. They supposed? Did they see him in there? If they had seen him in there, why didn't they call right then? Where's Trophimus in all this? They dragged Paul out. Where's Trophimus? Well, he's more of a felon than is Paul. Drag him out here. Kill him. That's like the men who brought the woman taken in adultery before Jesus. And they even says in the text, in the very act. Well, in the very act takes two people, takes two to tango. And so where's the man involved? Don't know. So when Luke says, they supposed, how did he know that? How did he get in their head, you know? I don't know. I think he's being gracious here. They supposed, they said it, they must have thought that that's true. No, I think maybe they were making this false accusation. They knew it was false. And then the mob, they didn't care. They just picked it up and went with it. So it might have been a logical mistake, but they didn't need even that much. They did it with whatever they had. So those were the accusers and the accusation. Now the actors. It was a mob scene. They're all over the place. Their passion is in verse 30. It says, and all the city was disturbed, and the people ran together and seized Paul and dragged him out and out of the temple and immediately shut the door. There was really no passion like a religious passion. If you read anything about the Crusades, you know that. That was total passion, total religious passion. We've got to get Jerusalem for some reason. That's the kind of thing. And you'll find it, the same thing is true here. They dragged Paul out. They closed the temple so Trophimus can't get out, I guess. where's James in all this? You know, I don't hear anything about James. Did the church come to Paul's aid? As far as we know, no. Did they go to the Jewish authorities, to the Roman authorities, and do something for him? Not that we know. If they did, Luke didn't record it. And I think that's strange, if they did, that Luke wouldn't record that here in the process. Anyway, but this rift in the church was really wide. Throughout the wherever the gospel had gone, there was a rift between the Jews and the Gentiles, and it was very serious, especially in Jerusalem. You just read the book of Hebrews sometime, written about this time to this people. You must read it in that light. So they didn't help, and if they did, maybe they did, and then it didn't work. But that's the passion that was involved here. Now the purpose. Now they were seeking to kill him, to kill Paul. And news came to the commander of the garrison that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. Now, they were going to kill Paul. There's no question about this. They're not out to make an example of him or whatever. They want to kill him. And they would have done, except for the Roman commander of that fort there next to the temple area. In fact, they had a you can't see it here, but I've seen it. There were stairs that came down on both sides right into the temple area. They didn't have to go downtown to get somebody. They were right there. They saw it, and they all came right down. And there were a thousand soldiers in that area, in that garrison. So the authorities would probably have done nothing to them, would have done nothing to the people if they had killed him, because that's religious. We'll stay away from that. But if they can stop it, if they can keep it from happening, then they would do so. And that's what they're trying to do here. This garrison was apparently ready for anything. 1,000 of them, and so they're going to come and do what they can. So the people were angered. Paul was arrested. Now Paul has a problem. His problem is he's being beaten by the rabble, 32. Immediately, the soldiers and the centurions ran down to them, and when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Now, there were hundreds of soldiers. A centurion is commanding 100 men. And it says, plural, centurions. So at least 200 men, maybe more. And a mob, no matter who they are, a mob is not any match for a trained soldier. If a trained soldier is willing to do whatever it takes to quell the problem. I know you're thinking to yourself, well, the mob did a pretty good job in Egypt. If they had taken a machine gun like that, they'd have cleared that square, no question. And how much do you think the Rome was afraid of world opinion in those days? Now, Rome wasn't afraid to do it, and they knew it. So they were beating, Paul was beaten by the rabble, but he was also bound by the Romans. Then the commander came near and took him and commanded him to be bound in two chains, and he asked who he was and what he had done. Now, two chains, that's probably enough to hold the aged Paul. Two chains? They were asking the question to the people, what did he do? Who is this guy? What did he do? They didn't know. Most of them did not even know who he was or what he had done. And they didn't care. Let's just make noise. So that was a problem. Now his people, their disorder, the people in verse 34, and some of them, the multitude cried one thing and another. So when he could not ascertain the truth because of the tumult, he commanded him to be taken into the barracks. Now, people in the mob don't know, don't care, so they couldn't answer him. And they were just caught up in the moment and hanging with the crowd and enjoying this whole thing. Since he's the focus of the trouble, they figure, okay, take him out and the problem's over. And at least get him out of there, get him out of the danger. So they took him out. Now, that's the disorder. Now the desire. When he reached the stairs, he had to be carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. And I picture that as they're holding up Paul above. The Jews aren't that tall, and they're carrying Paul above them so they can't beat him any longer. And he couldn't defend himself. Of course, he wouldn't anyway, probably. But they had put him up out of the reach, so they carried him up that way. So there's disorder, their desire. Now their demands. 36. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying, away with him. So another crowd said a similar thing a few years back from this about Jesus. Away with him. He's not fit to live. In Luke 23 and in John 19. So they still want Paul dead. And I think maybe Paul would remember his words. Remember what he said? I am willing to go and die in Jerusalem if I have to. Well, maybe this is it. Could well be. But see, God had other ideas. And God has other ideas in your life. God has a use for you. God wants you where he moves you. And he wants you to stay there. He wants you to be a witness. And if you'll do it, you'll please him. And he'll protect you in the process. And if he takes you to heaven, which he did Paul eventually, Paul, he was beheaded later on. He didn't deliver him every time, except that was a deliverance too, If the Lord has time for you to go, then you go, and you go out in a blaze of glory. So God had other plans for Paul, and he's going to keep him there. So the Roman soldiers became unwitting servants of God. They didn't know anything about God, didn't know anything about Jesus, didn't care. But they were used by God to deliver Paul from this situation. So, that's Paul's problem, the people, and then his plea. Verse 37 says, and he astonished the captain. As Paul went about to be led into the barracks, he said to the commander, may I speak to you? And he said it in Greek. I'm not going to try that. But he replied, do you know Greek? The English says, do you speak Greek? No. Do you know Greek? And he really astonished him with that. Because, he says, verse 38, he astounded the captain when he was not the Egyptian. Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up the rebellion and led 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness? See, Josephus writes about this too in his book, The War, Jewish Wars and Antiquities. He says there were 30,000 men there. Luke says 4,000. You can't trust Josephus. He exaggerates. I found it out various times. Anyway, it's a real act. It's a real incident because Josephus, the historian, writes about it. So he astounded the captain. Now he also assured the captain, verse 29. And Paul said, I am a Jew. I am from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city, and I implore you, permit me to speak to this people. Now, Paul, still speaking Greek, tells them that he is born in Tarsus, in Cilicia. But he doesn't say anything about his Roman citizenship unless, and this is interesting, he says, I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean Tarsus. I am a citizen of a very important city. You might consider that's Rome. So he may have meant that, but later on we know that the commander didn't catch it if he did. So Paul's not free, but Paul's alive. God saved him. He took him out of the hands of one danger into a custody of another, but he's still alive. He's still going, as we know now, having read the whole book of Acts, we know where he's going. He's going to Rome. And he's going there at Rome's expense, but he's going there as a minister of Jesus Christ. But he got out of this place. He was not killed. He was protected. God is able to deliver him. He's able to deliver you too. God is bigger. Bigger than any situation you'll ever face. Trust him, because now you belong to him.